accession number 20094, reel 6.
That's reel 6.
Right. It was very, very hot, as I was saying, and down below in the main WT office, conditions were really terrible because we were closed up at second degree because of the nature of the water that we were going through, second degree redness, and therefore at times the ventilation was shut off, and down below it was quite horrid, particularly in the main WT office. Luckily, the armoured hatch wasn't closed, but it was still quite torrid. We sailed south of Malta, and then we picked up with the War Spartan Valiant again. And then we had 4 H. The first division was Nelson, the Rodney, and the Formidable. Nelson, Rodney, and the Indomitable, and the second division was the Valiant and the Formidable. And we in the WT office were all gathered in all those that are off watch, and we were given a talk in by the chief tell and the squadron wireless assistant that we were on Operation Husky, which was the invasion of Sicily. And they read out various excerpts from what they call the HONCOs, that's the Husky Operational Naval Communication Orders, to us, to what was expected. And the we were there to prevent any intervention of the invasion forces by the Italian fleet. And so there we were, sailing up and down during the invasion of the invasion of Sicily, up and down the Ionian Sea. Adam protection. At one time we were asked to do a bombardment. We got close, and then the bombardment was cancelled, so we turned and came back. Then it was on again. Then this happened twice, and in the end we got a bit fed up with this, but we didn't bombard at that time. The war spy did. She did a bombardment. That's the first division. The Indomitable, Nelson and Rodney, we returned to Malta with our destroyers to refuel, or we go to Malta to refuel, and we got into Grand Harbour. We got in the morning, we sailed again at 4 o'clock. And our destroyers had all refueled and everything else, so we were to go back up there. And then we sent the 2nd Division in for them to refuel. And it was during the night, just after we sailed, just on midnight, in actual fact, I was on the Fleet Wave in the remote control office. And just after midnight, the Indomitable had she left some of her swordfish behind, swordfish air, or albacores, or swordfish, behind at Alfa at Malta. So she decided to land them on at night, using limited lighting. Unfortunately, an Italian torpedo bomber, everybody says it's a Ju-88, but I've read other journals since then, which indicated there was an Italian bomber, a torpedo bomber, came in and hit if you'd have measured between the bow and the stern and the pair of calipers, you couldn't have got nearer the centre. Hit it in amidships with the torpedo. The aircraft was still flying around, in actual fact, we tuned up an emergency set that we had in the remote control office, and I signalled to the aircraft to return to Malta. So I was quite chuffed with that. But the Indomitable, she took a very heavy list initially, but managed to get it sorted out. And eventually we got her back. We escorted her so far back to Malta. And we got the Formidable out to take her place for the rest of that patrol. The Indomitable, she seemed to be an unlucky ship. Twice she'd been with the Nelson, and twice she got within a year, and twice she'd got smashed up. When the Sicilian operations finished, I by then had been rated up to, I'd been rated up before we left Gib to ordinary telegraphist, backdated 5 months, because I'd passed the professional examinations, both skill wise and professional wise, to be rated at 17.5. Unfortunately, the school papers had been marked by Admiralty. They were not marked on board the ship, they had been marked by Admiralty. And though I took the examination in January, I did not get the results until the beginning of July. And then I was rated up to ordinary telegraphist then. I'd left the boys' mess deck. But because I got the six months seniority as an ordinary tell, I merely put in to become a telegraphist, and actually took my examination for telegraphist on board HMS Warspite at Malta. Well, the situation there was that we still went and did patrols. And then we went out and did a practice bombardment, Nelson and Rodney, and then we went up on the end of August. We went up to Reggio and bombarded there. There's some gun emplacements which were threatening the build up our invasion forces getting across the Straits of Messina. And so we bombarded at Reggio, which made great headlines in the papers. But we came back from there. Then we had an influx of masses and masses of more of American encryption officers and things like that who came on board the ship, and a few operators as well. They were all petty officer rating anyway, but they were operators. And we saw something big is coming up. The Euryalus came alongside us. She was the flagship of Admiral Vian, who in charge of Force V. Though it was a cruiser, he was in charge of all the carriers that were Force V aircraft carriers, which had come out there, the Hunter, the Stalker, the Biter, a lot of them. And then we sailed on the evening, September the 7th, or something there. We heard on the radio, anyway, that Italy capitulated, or slung their hand in, and that we were on our way to make a landing at Salerno. Well, everybody thought it was going to be a doddle because the Italians had packed it in, but it wasn't. Far, far from it. The purpose of all the carriers, Admiral Vian's Force V, and our own carriers that we had with us, were to provide the necessary air cover for the landing and a bombardment supporting role as required at Salerno. It was touch and go there for a while. We got the landing strips set up, and so we returned to Malta. Our part of the operation had been done, but the Germans launched quite a strong counter-offensive, and things were getting pretty bad. So the War Smart and the Valiant, we all put to sea, all the four states put to sea again. We went to Augusta, and the War Smart and Valiant went up and bombarded at Salerno, and that's where the War Smart was hit by the flying bombs, and were hit by a flying bomb, and had to be towed back to Malta. We came back from Augusta because the naval bombardment plus another offensive and a strong air offensive had beaten back the German counterattack. So things got more stable and progress was being made, and we were at Malta. In September, when we came back from, by the way, when we came back from Salerno, as we passed St. Paul's Bay and St. George's Bay, there were all the Italian battle fleet that surrendered lying there. And from a distance, they looked quite smart, but apparently they weren't all they were cracked up to be. Then one morning, we knew there was a lot going on. I had the forenoon watch. That's from 8 o'clock in the morning till 12:30. So therefore, I didn't see any of this. But an Italian cruiser came in, and on board her was General or Marshal Badoglio and all his staff and the British entourage and all the rest of it. We had the Governor of Malta and the CNC Medfleet and Eisenhower on board. And that's on board the Nelson was the official signature for the surrender, the Italian surrender that took place. And after that, things got rather quiet out there from the point of view of the big ships. The small ships were out and about all the time, but there was nothing for us to do. Our main reason for being there, the Italian battle fleet, was now had been dispersed to Alexandria and other places. There was really no real purpose for our battle fleet, and we just stoozed around there and until October, when we came back to the UK at the end of October. We were hoping for a last stop at Gibraltar on the way home, so we could buy lots and lots of the duty-free rabbits and things like that, but we didn't. We stopped at Algiers instead. And unfortunately, Algiers by that time had been completely dominated by the American and the American dollar, and the prices were sky high. There's nothing that we could buy.
Duty-free rabbits?
Well, rabbits, yeah. There's a naval term for presents for home or little gifts and things like that. We call them rabbits. Going ashore to buy presents is what's known as going on a rabbit run. So we didn't stop at Gib. We came back to Scapa From Scapa we went to into Rosyth Dockyard in the November. Have some work done, and after that was completed, we had 7 days leave each watch, and then we went back to Scapa, and in the third week in December, I was sent for and told I was on draft. In fact, our captain that we had, the Honourable Guy Russell, a wonderful guy, big chap, he's about 6'4" and he took size 14 shoes. But he beat me. He went to the Duke of York. In fact, he was the captain of the Duke of York when she sunk the Charnost. And it was made a remark that I got later from Commander or Captain Blunder when I used to go to see him. It was the commander aboard the Nelson, and he turned around and said, "I think I must be the only captain in the world who sunk another ship and didn't know the name of his gunnery officer." That was his comment. Anyway, I came to Mercury. I took my examination for trained operator, today was TO, that's an extra rate up, and past that, and then with a lot of other people I was sent for, a lot of other sparkers and bandits, you know, WT ratings and visual signalmen, sent for, I must have been about 35-40 of us to go on draft, and we all had the same ship, HMS Kingsmill. We'd never heard of this. So everybody was busy chaunting around about it. And then we suddenly found out that HMS Kingsmill were on the least end captain class frigates, the diesel electric one. That was just commissioning up with Tobermory. And we thought, why the hell do they need so many? A normal complement of all that ship would be a petty officer, a leading hand, and about four or five sparkers, you know. And here we were, a massive great number. We couldn't believe it. Anyway, we went on draft from Petersfield down to Portsmouth and all the way up to Oban to get the ferry, the Navy MFE, across to Tobermory. When we got there, people said, "Well, there's no good going there. The Kingsmill's gone. She didn't stay here." We thought that funny because Tobermory was the place where all the escort vessels worked up on their anti-submarine techniques prior to joining the escort groups in the Atlantic convoys. So he said, "You've got to go to Weymouth." So later on that night, or there, we entrained again all the way back to Weymouth. The journeys took about nearly 3 days altogether. We got to Weymouth, we were met by a very irate sub-lieutenant RMVR who said, "Where the hell have you been?" Chief Yeoman started a draft, told him in uncertain terms what had happened. In fact, I've never heard the word "sir" said with such derision in all my life. But anyway, he had a wonderful way of expressing it. Anyway, he said, "Well, Kingsland's alongside at Weymouth, but you're not ship's company. You are senior officer, assault group G2 staff." No, to us that didn't mean a thing. He said, a big lorry came along, and we went from Weymouth Station to a group of hotels right on the pier part of Weymouth called Devonshire Place then. I think it's called the Esplanade now, but it used to be there. All that part was fenced off, and it used to be HMS B, the MTB base, but that had been closed down. The MTBs have been reallocated to other depots. And it was now called HMS Grasshopper, and it was a combined ops base. And we were in number 6, which is the last one that faced right on the pier there. Of course, we say hotel, but there were just bare rooms with the usual pusser's 2-tier iron bedsteads in it, and that was it. The Kingswell was alongside, a very smart looking little ship. But what had happened, that she had been modified. They had built additional superstructure between the bridge and the funnel. They'd taken the after 3-inch gun off and built some extra superstructure there. They stepped a mainmast as well. And this additional superstructure was the new receiving office and the after superstructure, additional superstructure, were all the transmitters. She was officially classified as a landing ship headquarters bracket small, LCH bracket S, LSH bracket S. And we suddenly realised that the signal was a G2, that we were going to be responsible for Force G, Sector 2, whatever that meant at that time. Apparently, when Monty came back from the Russian desert and they started planning for the D-Day operations, there were 2 American forces and 2 British forces. He said he wanted a third force to cover the area that he wanted. And the Force G was had to join with Force J and Force S. They said, given these numbers, will be apparent when they know that Force J operated from Juno Beach, Force S operated from Saw Beach, Force G operated from Gold Beach. Each one had its own headquarters ship, the Hillary, the Largs, and the Bilolo, as in Force G was the Bilolo. But on each of these sectors, you had a small headquarters ship in close inshore, signaling them back, controlling the beaches in their sector. And Kingswell controlled 2 beaches, Item and Jig, I think it was, near Arnsness during the D-Day landings. We stayed there, and we used to go on board the ship to do exercises and things like that, but because of the cramped conditions, we lived mainly in this hotel. Then Force G moved from Weymouth, Portland area to the Southampton area, and we then transferred from Grasshopper to HMS Squid. We still lived in ashore. In actual fact, in a street opposite Woolworths, I forget the name of it now, but there was a road there. There's some partially damaged buildings, and we were in one of those.
This is Portsmouth. Portsmouth.
In Southampton. And from there, we used to go on board the ship for exercises, then gradually spending more time on the ship, and then eventually we moved to the ship. That was on the very end of May, beginning of June, obviously, for ready for D-Day landings. and we were conducting operations, exercise operations, the flow of traffic, starting at about 8 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning till about 4 in the afternoon and stopping. We did this for about 5 or 6 days before D-Day. All our call signs that we used were, remember the two in particular, that the King's Mills call sign was 3ZIR and the SOAGG2's call sign was 3QIR. And then we were told they were going to be changed to the letter 6 instead of the letter 3. This is for the invasion. But as you know, that the invasion was cancelled for 24 hours. And to ensure that there wasn't a lull and all the rest of it, we had to come up and do some mythical exercises on the day that we should have been on the invasion day, just to keep the pattern. Just to keep the pattern fresh, in case of, what's happening, you know. And so we did. We sailed on there, we were off the beachhead. In fact, we helped the Guardian, our first load of landing craft, to get into position. And we were off the beachhead all that day. There were three captain class frigates that were converted. There are lots of others, River class and others. The Lawford and the Dacres were two others, captain class ones. And 2 days later, the Lawford was sunk, actually. And she was SOAGJ1. So we had fun and games. The most horrendous part about it, I remember D-Day, was the fact that all the bombarding ships, the crews of the Orion and all those, they were firing over us to hit their targets, and you could hear them going overhead. Then the Flores, that was a Dutch gunboat, she was part of the bombarding. Being much shallower draft and everything else, she almost came up, and she was within a matter of, she anchored herself about not more than 100 yards away from us, and she was belting away with her guns, and you could feel the reverberations right through our ship as she fired. Our job after D-Day was to maintain the logistic flow up through onto the beaches, controlling the landing craft and ships that were coming in. And this carried on right until the gales that we had over in D-Day, which were quite horrendous. And there's a saying in the Navy that the ship will roll on wet grass. in King's Mills 1, that definitely did. They looked top-heavy in their natural state, but when modified with the additional superstructure and an extra mast as well, with all the top hamper, they were very, very lively in that rough weather. In actual fact, it was almost impossible to keep on watch. You had to jam your legs underneath the benches and try to keep yourself from being swung around. Your chairs were fastened to the deck, screwed into the deck there at the central spigot. But the